Okay, we're resuming now. This is tape two, and I'm speaking with Stephen Baker, and it's August 18th, 1994. Okay, so you're saying that all the different kinds of jobs that
right,
you
and ended up in a major agency, and become reasonably successful in a short time. I was vice president in my early 30s, and got substantial amount of publicity on some of my work. Probably the one that was most important was Let Your Fingers Do the Walking for the Yellow Pages, because of the support of AT&T, which is a large company. If you get into something like that, you receive a great deal of exposure. But I think that what helped me a lot in my career was the variety of experiences in my background, the understanding of America, which sounds curious, but it's probably different from the average person because nothing came naturally. I studied, I read, and I think I must have read the New York Times beginning at age 30, and I don't think I missed a day. It's still, even at this age, to me it's a great, I'm a kid in a toy shop. I mean, it's all very exciting to me. In a way, you know, life is very interesting to me, and I feel lucky that I get so much joy out of discovering things. That helped a lot because in a way it put me in the situation at the same time. It never quite, I was always able to, because of the differences in cultures, it was always remained somewhat this looking from the outside in type of approach, which you get if you dropped into a totally new situation, and you go through that experience once, you never forget it, and it kind of becomes part of your personality. I mean, when I crossed the United States on top of freight cars, I had my camera with me. I was put in jail. I was taking notes. I was put in jail because I wasn't supposed to travel as an enemy alien, which I ignored. And I kept a diary. I still have about 20 books of everything. This kind of experience, which has become part of personality, you know, helped a lot in advertising, where you deal with so many different demographics and so many different people. Also, advertising is trying to keep ahead of trends, and when you become conscious of this society, which changes, you know, much faster than any other in the world. When you become conscious of it, you develop a curiosity and an ability to predict trends as they come and see them coming. And even now, if you would ask me about music or fashion or what the changes in our society, I could probably write about it or talk about it. It's to me, it's very interesting. I read a lot too. And my friends come from all walks of life. This helped in advertising. I'm not sure if this has much to do. It has something to do with the background. In Europe, you find more Renaissance people. That is, things are not quite as specialized because it's a smaller society. You can do a number of things at the same time, and it's perfectly okay. I thought it was quite natural to be able to have artistic ability to draw, which I learned in evening classes, learn and be artistically inclined, work with pictures, and at the same time be work with words too. In other words, a combination of art and writing to me became a natural marriage. I didn't see the difference. Now, of course, when you work in an advertising agency, you're either an art director or you're a copywriter. But and I was an art director because I didn't master the language enough, at least in the opinions of my superiors, to be a copywriter. So they put me in the art department. So I became a kind of an art director. This is how, this was probably responsible for a fairly quick rise in the advertising business. As an art director, I discovered quite soon that most art directors felt almost alienated from the word people. In other words, there were two camps. One was dealing with pictures, the other one was dealing with words, and they took it as a it was obvious to both camps that one had nothing to do with the other, and they were at odds. To me, it was the same thing, was communications. And so I became one of those art directors who could actually write. Now, in the agency, this wasn't that simple because of the tendency to put things in pigeonhole people and say, this is what you are, and, you know, put up or shut up.
So
on the other hand, there was this drive on my part to verbally express myself too. So what I began to do is to write articles for magazines and write about advertising to advertising people, mm-hmm. for advertising people. I would write for general magazines too, but that's something else. But basically, I spent a considerable amount of time explaining advertising to advertising people, and particularly art direction. And this was in that time, and at that time was quite a breakthrough because I was probably the first verbal art director that ever burst upon the scene. And I did it, and it happened in a very obvious way, because when you're in print, people know who you are. I got my pictures there. And so I was writing articles, was writing columns first for a magazine called Art Direction, and then quickly a magazine called Advertising Age, which is the Bible in the industry, came about and asked me to do a monthly column, a bi-monthly column for them, first on Art Direction and then on advertising. And I did that for many, many years, about 15 years, 16 years. But that kind of exposure became very helpful, because thousands of clients would read Advertising Age. So I became important for my own company as a spokesman and somebody who was known for his creativity. Not because necessarily I was more creative, but I was the only one who could put it on paper. Mm-hmm. So we get accounts, as a result of it, and I became an executive probably faster than most people. And eventually, I was writing copy, and after my campaign for AT&T, I decided to go into business on my own with the help of AT&T, and I have an agency for over 20 years. And developed, you know, we had some large accounts, 70 people, and that's my advertising background.
Can you think of any attitudes that that you brought with you? I mean, you've sort of mentioned some of them. I mean, the rootlessness was a helpful thing, but any attitudes that came through your mother, father, stepfather that you would say that you used in your lifetime mm-hmm. or drew upon?
Well, I think that this is pretty common. I think you develop certain attitudes when you change cultures and you accept the fact that you are going to live in a different culture. Now, you mentioned before that some people get stuck in their own culture anyway, it's just going from one location to another. Chinatown is Chinatown. But if you have that kind of experience, which is almost traumatic experience, it's a shock therapy, it's a culture shock, then I think your mind becomes a little more open and flexible. It's got to, because you have to reject a whole lot of beliefs that you had before. And
can you think of some you rejected? Maybe that would be.
Well, I rejected the kind of patriotism that I learned as a child in Hungary, which was very militaristic and no nonsense and terribly important. That it was the greatest thing that could ever happen to you was to be killed in war for your country. I don't mean I rejected it to the point all three of us served in the army, but I certainly took on a different approach to war and fighting, because the Americans are quite pragmatic about wars. Relatively little emotionalism and a lot of practicality. And by and large, we're a very peaceful nation. We're not inviting war. As far as I can see, most of our wars were defensive. Some people will argue that, but depending on the way you look at it. That's one of this militaristic attitude. Now that's Hungarian, you know, where the Hussars comes from, and all kind of nonsense that goes with a culture that is over 1,000 years old and has been in wars after wars. I also became conscious of the fact that military power was not necessarily on the top of the list of success. It wasn't the only thing that would predict a nation's success. And a good example of this today, of course, is Japan and Germany, which has practically no military power and are among the most successful nations in the world. In other words, I became conscious of the fact that economy and your intelligence had as much to do with success as tanks, the number of tanks or the military. That's one of the things. You ask what I rejected, is
what
that
you what rejected, you? And on the other hand, what did you embrace, if you can think of it that way,
right.
In this country as a cultural attitude, you might say?
Well, talking about rejections, I also reject. I thought it wasn't that important to be a Hungarian. When I came to America, from day one, I wanted to be an American. To the point of absurdity. I mean, as a young man, you know, I would go to movies, and down that time, there were movies where you could walk in and stay as long as you want. And I thought, my God, for 10 cents, I can stay there for 4 hours. I would stay for 4 hours and see the same movie over and over again to get my money's worth. But basically, I was very much intrigued by the movie heroes of those days that represented America, the Gary Coopers, the John Waynes, the Jimmy Stewarts, and that kind of thing. That made a profound impression on me, to the point where I began to swagger and go to Texas and do all kind of things to be like them. Went through that phase. I think American system, what I embraced is a remarkable phenomenon in history. Looking at it in a larger sense, the way I see it now, and probably embraced it in small doses, the fact that it's possible, that it was possible only a short time ago, less than 300 years ago, for a group of people to sit down at the desk and write some sort of a platform for the way we want to function, and then do it, and actually build a nation on a planned basis, as opposed to in small, as opposed to piecemeal, which is what happens in Europe, has happened in Europe, is to me absolutely incredible. I can't believe it. I can't believe it now, that you know, that our fathers, forefathers, in Philadelphia, you would sit down and write a constitution and say, this is the way to go, and then stick with that constitution for this long without any major problems. I mean, of course, we made amendments, we changed the constitution, it's supposed to be flexible. But to me, it's amazing that this was possible, and I'm not sure if Americans or even the world realized this phenomenon. I mean, this is fantastic. Now, of course, everybody is imitating success, which is America, and everybody is trying to do the same thing. There are nations now that are trying to write constitutions, Russia for one, you know, following our footsteps. But we were basically the first ones that did this in such a major way. And that I can't get over this. I still admire this. I also admire the fact that we can accommodate so many different cultures and still live in relative peace. We have our problems, but they're minimal compared to other nations in the world.
Are you talking about cultures of people from other countries? Or
from different
regional?
Different nations. The regional, we don't have many regional differences. We have some, you know, the Southerners don't like the Yankees and so forth, but that's compared to other parts of Europe where you actually see, where you see parts of the country breaking off, like in Yugoslavia, you know, that, or in other countries, that's minimal. That's mostly the stuff that television is made of. I think it's remarkable. I, looking at, as somebody with an immigration experience, I'm somewhat taken aback by some of the people who come over and so are so adamant in keeping their ways and cultures at the expense of what I consider is an American culture. I do think that we have our own culture. We don't always realize just how strong it is until we go to Europe someplace and listen to them talking about America. America does have, at this point, and this is only about 200 years, has developed its own ways and culture, which is imitated all over the world. We probably are culture, we have probably made the most profound cultural differences in the world that any nation ever made, including Germany with all his musicians and poets, and or France with all its wonderful culture. I think it's what we have is so much more powerful.
How could you try to pinpoint what it is that makes American culture stand apart from the cultures, European cultures in particular, I guess?
It's a very open mind to changes. And you can see how fast our music changes, our heroes change. We have a very short attention span. That's not necessarily a personality trait. The reason for that is because we have such powerful media. And if anything that happens gets an enormous amount of exposure, people get saturated by it and forget it. I'm amazed how quickly people forget, how quickly something comes to people's attention. The O.J. Simpson trial is an example. The things that happen in Africa is an example. Right now, it's a Rwanda problem. Tomorrow, it'll be something else. As a writer, I'm very much aware of this because I watched the books come out on the Persian Gulf War, and I spoke to publishers and I said, how many did you print? I mean, this war will be over within a few months and you'd better sell out. They said, we know it, and we just printed enough. Some people got stuck, some people didn't. As soon as that war was over, we forgot about it. As soon as the utopian, the African starvation problems were over, we forgot about it. Now we have new ones. Yugoslavia was very much in the foreground a few months back. We forget it. The Olympics, the ice skating problem we had were on the cover of magazines, and now it's all over. Nobody knows Kerrigan. Nobody remembers.
Whereas in Europe,
these things are much. They stay. They become part of culture. Less and less so, but but still, compared to the Americans' speed and the rapidity by which we change, Europeans don't even, they still don't understand it. They don't understand how we can have two Woodstocks only 25 years apart. One is sponsored by, one becomes a mass market affair, and the other one becomes an expression of a whole new set of idealism. We can't understand how that is possible, but it's part of the American psyche. That's the language, of course, shows it too. The language changes so fast. I did an article on that one time about the English language, which I'll be happy to give you. You know, talking about the fact that in America you have new dictionaries coming out every year. In Europe it's maybe every 20 years, because things don't change that fast. That's part of this culture. I'm not sure if it's good or bad, but I know it is possible and I know it's working, because we're able to change more rapidly than anybody, even Japan. So it's amazing to me, although I foresaw it, and it's a good thing I did, because I invested my money with that in mind, that we would be climbing out of our recession quite quickly. I could see that the American corporations would respond by cutting their overhead, becoming more efficient. All that became, that's very American. There isn't another country in the world, Japan or Germany, are still struggling to get back on their feet. And now I understand just the other day that we have become the number one automobile manufacturer in the world. Japan was all over us only 5 or 10 years ago. And the way we did it is GM cut its force, made operations more efficient, and just get their act together. Other countries don't do that. There's much more. They're much more security conscious, personal security. In Japan, up to the last few years, when you got a job, it was a lifetime job. In Germany too, very socialistic. I don't know if that's good or bad, depending on your own proclivities, but it's part of our culture. I embrace that because I thrive on it, I live on it. Good example is when I do books. The last 4 books I did, and I got 2 more to go. 2 more are going to be published. Books on cats. Now people ask me why cats. They ask me if I have a cat. No, I don't have it. I don't have a cat. I borrowed one. And so they're amazed by it, but I'm not, because I see the marketplace, and right now, for the last 2 or 3 or 4 years, cats are in. So, you know, we did books and sold 200,000 or 300,000 copies on cats. I also know that 2 or 3 years from now, this one cats will not work. We got to find something else. Used to be dogs, and I did books on dogs too. But I could see dogs going downhill and cats coming into the foreground. So this is, of course, you know, a very superficial way of looking at things, but it's indicative of the way we think. And understanding it and coming from another culture, to be able to understand it more so, I think is important. I think it helped me a lot. Uh-huh. Because
you can stand
outside. I can look from outside in. And I see these, and I have no great belief systems, you know, where I think that cats are the only pets to have, you know. I just, I'm amused by it, I enjoy it. I learn about the subject whichever way I can. It doesn't have to come from deep inside. It'll come from deep inside once I absorb it, once I learn about it, then I write about it. So I think that that kind of attitude, I think, goes back to going through different cultures.
By the way, did you ever have contact with your father after you left?
Yes, we after the war, we found him. And he lived another 10 years, 15 years.
In Europe?
In Europe. We invited him to come to America. He didn't want to. He was in his 60s, 50s, 60s. But we visited him in Budapest, and we found out his story. And it was pretty much the way he predicted it would be. Eventually, he was classified as a Jew. In the final solution in 1943, when it became obvious that to Germany that they were losing the war, and Hitler, in his last hurrah, decided to kill all the Jews, he finally got to Hungary. He didn't, at that time, the relationship between Hungary and Germany has become somewhat difficult, because Hungary was trying to end the war, and of course Germany would fight on, Hitler would fight on as long as he could. And finally, the final solution, which was a methodology, has come to Hungary. At the end of the war, it only lasted for about a year, but Hitler managed to do away with most of the Jews outside Budapest. He began to exterminate or export Jews first in outside Budapest, because he felt that this would be easier to deal with, because people were less sophisticated, they were possibly more anti-Semitic. It was easier to find, to spot Jews, to find them and to transport them. And as long as the freight cars were moving, he was happy. He thought this was some sort of an achievement. This was probably his only way, the only part of the war that he was winning. He was losing, and the more he was losing in the real sense, the more he depended on this kind of a display of his power. That's my opinion. He finally got to Budapest, and he began to take Jews to Auschwitz on freight cars. There was an enormous shortage of freight cars. The military needed it for its own transport, but Hitler wouldn't let them have it. It's more important to him to take the Jews to concentration camps. And my father, who was at that point was ghettoized, he lived in an apartment with a Star of David on the door and certain parts of Budapest, was caught. He was taken to what is referred to as a brick factory, which was a place where they would gather up the Jews and take them to railway station and transport them out of Hungary. He was taken there, but he escaped. A number of people did, taking a large group of people at night, walking them on the streets is not an easy task. Plus the fact that not all the guards were German, many of them were Hungarians, and they didn't quite approve of the whole thing to begin with. So he managed to hide, escape. They found him. At that point, Hitler had pretty much stopped transporting Jews because the war was, the Russians were only 50 or 100 miles away. There were other things to do, but a Hungarian party, the Arrow Shirts, took over, continuing his program, and they rounded up all the Jews, including my father. I think I told you that. And they lined up all the Jews at the bank of the Danube. That's where my book comes in. And they just, you know, shoot them one by one. But some people, including my father, managed to jump backwards into the river before the gun got to them. And this was much, most of these people, they drowned or froze or whatever. But my father managed to, he was an excellent swimmer. That's what my book is about, you know. He always teaches us to swim. Swim or sink, was his famous. And then he himself saved his life by following his own motto. And that's how he escaped, and he did okay. He remarried, and he went into business again, and he somehow managed to survive.
So what your book that you're writing, The Danube, what does that cover? I mean,
it just covers the Hungarian experience. Otherwise, it would get too complicated. It basically, the point is that, you know, it's a book on survival. Maybe it's not such a bad thing, bad experience to go through that for a young man. It's something that comes in handy.
Well, it sounds like you've made the most of all the kinds of experiences that you have encountered in your life. I was curious too, you said you had movie star heroes when you were learning English and first in this country. Did you have heroes after that, other heroes that you emulated in your life that you can think of?
No, most of the heroes I had were in advertising, professional heroes. People who succeeded in advertising, and I admire their work, commercials, you know. I mean, that to me was the ultimate. I became very, very much involved in my work.
Okay, I think we can close. This has been absolutely wonderful.
Well, I hope, that's about it.
Okay, I've been speaking with Stephen Baker. And it's August 18th, 1994. This is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm signing off.